This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating 40 years of craftsmanship, April 3rd through 30th. For a store location near you, you can visit www.peets.com. That's P-E-E-T-S.
To be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, local activists are stepping up the Impeach Bush Project.
An Amnesty International report links Evergreen Aviation in McMinnville to the Bush administration's extreme rendition policy.
And a revolution may be at hand in Nepal. We speak to reporter Reese Ehrlich, who just returned from there.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,375 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,100 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 32,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. In 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 18th, 2006. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Stephanie Potter. A new report suggests that an Oregon company may be involved with human rights violations. Evergreen International Aviation, based in McMinnville, has historical ties to the Central Intelligence Agency. A new report by Amnesty International mentions the company as one of a handful of private airlines possibly involved with the secret transport of detainees held by the CIA. Amnesty says this practice of rendition is being used to transfer prisoners to countries with histories of human rights abuses. Once there, the detainees can be interrogated and tortured away from the eyes of the international community. KBOO's Jacob Fenston has more.
Rendition refers to the transfer of prisoners from one location to another in a manner that bypasses international law. One way this is done is by using private, not government, aircraft. Private planes don't need prior authorization to fly over or make technical stops in foreign countries. This means the movement of the planes is harder to trace, and the planes themselves aren't easily linked to the U.S. government. Eric Sears with Amnesty International says there is no evidence directly linking McMinnville-based Evergreen International Aviation to the CIA rendition program.
The reason why we were particularly concerned in inquiring with Evergreen's operations is because they're part of only a very small select group of private airline companies that are able to land on U.S. military bases. And what we do know is that Evergreen has been linked in the past with connections to covert intelligence and military operations.
Evergreen's most recent permit to land on U.S. bases worldwide expired April 1st. It's one of only 10 companies to hold such a permit. Evergreen did not respond to inquiries by Amnesty International as to the purpose of those permits. Evergreen came into its present form in 1975. That year, Congress put pressure on the CIA to sell off the airlines it owned and operated. During the Vietnam War, the CIA had more than $50 million invested in private airlines it operated as front companies, according to a report by CBS. When it decided to sell its airline, Intermountain Aviation, the CIA offered it to Evergreen and to no one else. Evergreen was allowed to purchase Intermountain at a fraction of its value, and several CIA executives were included in the deal. Intermountain's vice president stayed on with Evergreen for 12 years. The former director of the CIA's proprietary airlines was hired as a consultant and later joined the board of directors. A former CIA pilot became vice president. In 1975, the company was also involved in purchasing Johnson Flying Service. Though Johnson and the CIA had no official connection, many of the company's pilots had been recruited by the CIA and worked for Intermountain. In 1988, a nine-part report in the Oregonian chronicled numerous cases of alleged CIA involvement. In 1984, CBS reported that Evergreen was involved with the secret transfer of weapons to anti-Sandinista rebels in Nicaragua. Evergreen has denied any links to the CIA and did not return KBOO's calls in time for broadcast. The CIA's rendition program is often used to transfer prisoners to U.S. custody, to places like Guantanamo Bay. It's also used to transfer detainees to secret black sites run by the CIA in unknown locations across the world. The Amnesty report cites the examples of three Yemeni men who were held in such sites and transferred there using rendition. The men had never known each other but told Amnesty strikingly similar stories of their detention. They were each picked up in 2003 for minor offenses.
One was detained for a violation of their visa. Another was completely just swept off the street.
They were released in Yemen earlier this year.
Now, before arriving to Yemen, all three men were moved around via rendition to secret prisons, which we think are possibly CIA black sites, for 18 months, where they faced inhuman treatment and regular interrogations in an attempt to link them to terrorist organizations.
One of the men, Muhammad al-Assad, was arrested in Tanzania in December 2003 and turned over to U.S. custody. There, he says, he was questioned by two FBI officers. In April 2004, he was shackled with his ears, eyes, and mouth covered and flown to a secret detention center, the location of which remains unknown. In May 2005, he was returned to Yemen, where he spent a further 9 months in prison. 2.5 years after his arrest, he was finally brought to trial, but was not charged with anything related to terrorism. He was tried on charges of forging a travel document and released March 14th this year.
How much have I lost? My morale, my reputation. I've suffered. My children are young. My child was born after I was taken. My father is old.
That's Muhammad al-Assad in an interview earlier this year. Amnesty says these are the only publicly documented cases of individuals who've been through the U.S. secret detention sites.
The United States government is attempting to operate a law-free zone. These detention centers have clearly been created in an attempt to circumvent both U.S. and international law. Under international law, the International Committee for the Red Cross, of course, is supposed to have access to all detainees. That's not happening. These individuals are being denied their due process rights under international law, and certainly these individuals are clearly facing acts that are tantamount to torture or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which is a violation of international law as well.
The U.S. government maintains these secret sites have small populations. They say the sites only hold high-value terror suspects, the worst of the worst.
The cases of these three Yemeni men point to a very different story. Obviously, they weren't very high value if they were eventually returned to Yemen, and the government of Yemen just released them within the past couple of weeks.
Amnesty maintains the CIA's program of secret detentions and secret renditions is much larger than the government lets on. Here's Amnesty's Anne Fitzgerald.
It's very difficult to get an accurate sense of the scale of the problem because, by its nature, it's a practice that happens in secret. The indications that we've had from what CIA officials have said and other people have said is that it's a number in the hundreds. Former CIA officials have said the hundreds. CIA officials have testified before the 9/11 Commission in Washington that 70 or 80 people have been rendered. And just last year, the Prime Minister of Egypt said that more than 70 people had been rendered to Egypt alone. So we're quite confident that it's a number in the hundreds, but we have no idea where in the hundreds it is.
The CIA is reportedly investigating some 35 cases of erroneous rendition, cases where people have been detained based on flawed evidence or confusion over names. Amnesty will continue to monitor CIA front companies and private companies like Evergreen that may be involved in renditions and human rights violations. I'm Jacob Fenston, KBOO News.
Amnesty will be in Portland later this month, where it's holding its annual general meeting. The three-day meeting is open to the public, and there will also be a denounced torture rally in Pioneer Courthouse Square. That's Friday the 28th at 4 o'clock. We'll be covering Amnesty's Portland visit in detail next week.
Gasoline prices keep going up. Yesterday marked the first time ever that crude oil trading closed at more than $70 a barrel. That helped push up gasoline prices by an average of 10 cents a gallon nationally. Oregon was close behind with a jump of 9 cents per gallon. The Medford-Ashland area had the highest average price in Oregon at $2.75 a gallon.
Gas prices aren't the only thing high in the Medford-Ashland area. The Phoenix, Oregon chief of police was arrested March 28th on charges of covering up his son's involvement in a marijuana party at the chief's home. Yesterday, the Phoenix, Oregon City Council voted to have the Jackson County Sheriff run their police force temporarily. The move came weeks after Phoenix Chief of Police Bob Kershaw was arrested for covering up his son's involvement in a marijuana party at the chief's home. Officials removed Bob Kershaw, the former police chief, from duty. The charges against Kershaw are forgery, hindering prosecution, official misconduct, tampering with physical evidence, and tampering with public records. Council chambers in Phoenix yesterday were filled with residents, law enforcement agents, and city employees, hoping to learn what would happen to the city police force. Mayor Vicki Baer said the fate of the department would not be determined until an assessment by the sheriff's department and an audit by a neutral third party.
Former Portland Police Chief Charles Moose has signed up for the Honolulu Police Department's Training Academy. His wife told reporters he intends to become a patrol officer again. Moose is also the former police chief of Montgomery County, Maryland. He became known as the main law enforcement spokesman in the Washington, D.C. area during the investigation of two men accused of 10 murders in a shooting spree in 2002. Moose resigned as Montgomery County Police Chief in 2003 after criticism from county ethics officials that he was cashing in on his job by writing a book about the 2002 serial sniper case that made him a national celebrity. Moose also made news in 2003 when he threatened to sue a Hawaiian resort over an alleged incident of racial discrimination. He settled for an undisclosed amount. Over the last 3 years, Moose has crossed the country on book signing tours, and he is a popular speaker.
President Bush sharply defended Donald Rumsfeld at a press conference today, saying the embattled Pentagon chief is doing a fine job, despite calls for his resignation from six retired military generals. Bush already had interrupted his Easter vacation at Camp David, Maryland, on Friday to release a public statement of support for the defense secretary. Despite a practice of not usually commenting on personnel moves, the president told reporters Tuesday that his vote of confidence for Rumsfeld was an effort to stamp out speculation about his status. Quote, "I'm the decider, and I decide what is best," Bush said.
The movement to impeach George W. Bush is gaining momentum around the country. Locally, a team of activists affiliated with the National Impeachment Coalition is looking for more volunteers. Live with us in Studio 2 is the Portland contact, Barbara Ellis. Barbara, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
First, tell us about the National Coalition to Impeach the President. How long have you been involved, and who is participating with you?
We've been involved. My group has been involved since January. We've been up on the ramparts with the impeach signs, etc. We're the national. It is growing to such a moment, such a movement that it is a national coalition, as you're mentioning here. You can go on Google and you will find about 12 or so sites, and they're all feeding into this coalition. Would you like me to give you the website for people who want to Google this?
Please do.
All right. www.pdamerica.org. Again, www.pdamerica.org.
Great. Why are you pursuing this project, Barbara? Do you really think Bush will be impeached?
Well, the first part of your question is that when we were putting out a newspaper in the Middle East, and if you're any place else in this country, you begin to value the Constitution and this great country. And we are fast slipping into a dictatorship. When you have a unitary president instantly ordering this, instantly ordering that, this last week, we learned, thanks to Seymour Hersh and also the Jerusalem Post, they are planning a secret second preemptive attack, this one on Iran. And I think they have like 400 sites, and they were planning to do 12. And the revelations, instantly we noticed the president a week ago said, oh, that's wild speculation. And I noticed when Scott McClellan was responding to press questions by Helen Thomas, six of them in the transcript, he used the word wild speculation, which means Karl Rove gave him the words. And then the next day, Rumsfeld on C-SPAN and his interview with the press, and they are no longer laughing at his little side jokes, used Fantasyland. And then he denied, he said Fantasyland. So they're busy denying what they get caught red-handed at. And I notice as if for such a big story on the talk shows this weekend, I mean, was this explored? I don't think so. The Fourth Amendment, the Constitution, if we no longer have one and you keep picking away at it, we're not going to have a Constitution. We have, I mean, the right to privacy, Fourth Amendment. This is, I mean, he overthrew that and defended it. That is one of the high crimes and misdemeanors for which the evidence now is in. So he has all these other high crimes and misdemeanors that they will have to prove. But this one is a self-admitted one.
Quickly, one last question. What do you think is the most important thing KBOO listeners should know about the impeachment project and about the national movement to impeach the president?
They can join our efforts here in Portland. My My particular group, Democracy for America, over on Powell, has singularly started an action movement. We just when we heard Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi saying, we don't want to impeach the president, we'll get Cheney, and you know, then Joe Biden saying, well, you know, let's just help Bush, we were furious, and we joined in. We did not know how many organizations, how many cities, how many. San Francisco, for example, has passed a resolution to impeach. We did not know how many people were doing this, but we knew we got to do some action here. And so we're doing flyering. We are holding the banners up on those overpasses, but we're also lobbying the incumbents running for Congress, because that's got to be done. We were also over in Eastern Oregon at Madras, and the four candidates running against Greg Walden all said in a public meeting to Cheers that they were going to support impeachment. And now Klamath Falls, the Democratic Party, is exploring the methods that we're using up here. We can use some flyering folk. I'm going to be recruiting tomorrow night at Starbucks on 36th and Hawthorne. You'll see the impeachment signs, but we're flyering Portland.
Thanks, Barbara. That was Barbara Ellis, point person of local efforts to impeach President Bush. For more information, go to www.pdamerica.org.
A new study says that rural school districts in Oregon have the widest funding gap in the nation. The study also says students in rural districts that receive the most tax money outperform those in other rural districts. The study showed an average difference of more than $1,600 per student between high-achieving and low-achieving districts. Three other factors also influenced achievement: teacher quality, poverty, and the educational level in the community. The study was funded by the Rural School and Community Trust. It compared those factors for 132 small and rural districts, along with student performance on state reading and math tests. The Virginia-based Trust advocates for strong rural schools and does regular academic studies on their funding and performance.
Oregon House and Senate leaders are promising a short, productive special session when lawmakers meet this week. They are meeting to provide more money for Oregon's schools and wipe out a human services budget deficit. Placing new restrictions on payday lenders and toughening penalties for sex crimes against children are also on the agenda. Lawmakers will be under pressure to keep the session brief. Renovations to the Capitol's electrical system will require the power to be cut off at 7 p.m. Friday and remain off for 10 days. Contractors say delaying the scheduled electrical work would cost the state an estimated $48,000 a day. Individual lawmakers could try to bring up additional subjects that could add to the length of the session. But Democratic Senate President Peter Courtney and Republican House Speaker Karen Minnis say they are determined not to let that happen.
A concerned citizen staged a protest 60 feet up a tree outside of Representative Brian Baird's Vancouver, Washington office to protest the congressman's co-sponsorship of a bill that promotes post-fire logging. The tree sitter, Adrian Haley, says that Baird is ignoring evidence that salvage logging in burned areas increases the fire risk and slows the recovery process. I interviewed Adrian Haley this afternoon and filed this report. Washington Democrat Brian Baird is co-sponsor of a bill with Oregon Republican Greg Walden to streamline rules and limit environmental review of salvage logging. Some people object.
Essentially, I climbed up the tree Saturday night, set up a platform with a banner outside of Baird's office, literally 20 feet from his front door, into 60 feet up into a Douglas fir tree, and I intended to stay until Saturday this weekend, this coming weekend, on Earth Day.
That was Adrian Haley, who's with a group called Folks for the Forest. The group is protesting Baird's co-sponsorship of the bill.
Well, essentially, I got involved in the issue when I got wind of this new study, and hearing about H.R. 4200 really showed me that science is contradicting the bill. And Baird has sort of ignored the evidence about logging after forest fires. And essentially, it slows the recovery process. It increases the fire risk even, which to me is a clear reason not to do salvage logging.
Haley's complaint is that Baird is ignoring peer-reviewed science.
One of his quotes was essentially that the science, which was done by OSU, and there were 30 other reviews that sort of support the data, he was essentially saying that these 30 different reports are misleading and inherently flawed, and that's a quote from him.
Haley was referring to a study by Daniel Donato, a grad student in forestry at Oregon State University. Haley charges that Baird is not dealing with the complexities of forest management.
He's basing it on, as he says, common sense. Unfortunately, forests are so extremely complex and the ecosystems are so interconnected that common sense, you know, although it's important to keep it in mind, common sense isn't a good way to manage a forest.
Haley was able to spend only one night in the tree. On Sunday, he was notified by the police chief that he was trespassing and would be forcibly removed, but the chief was willing to negotiate.
Well, after he realized that we were, you know, reasonable people and that we weren't up there to create problems or disturbance as much as just to get the word out, he called Baird's office for us and negotiated a meeting.
Yesterday, Haley's group met with Baird's staff and presented a number of requests, including dropping sponsorship of the bill and setting up public meetings where scientists from all sides could debate the issue.
We also demanded that he listen to peer-reviewed science in the future and that essentially that he honor his own statements that he had made earlier, 2004, where he said that part of the government's role is to listen to peer-reviewed science.
The bill H.R. 4200 has presently passed through committees in the House and could be up for a vote at any time.
I think it would be important for people to know that legislation is passing that is jeopardizing a lot of the protections of our forest, and people should keep their ears open and eyes open for developing political situations.
Adrian Haley with Folks for the Forest. He mentioned that tonight the O2 Collective is having a demonstration with slideshows at 7:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Southeast Portland. There is a posting for the event on Indie Media. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
Salmon advocates will challenge in court a decision not to return the Oregon coastal coho salmon to the threatened species list. The environmental groups argue that the January decision by NOAA Fisheries violates the Endangered Species Act. They say it goes against the best available science and relies on a new theory that coho can rebound from very low populations. The fish was listed in 1998, but a federal judge ruled in 2001 that NOAA had erred in how it granted the protection. 2 years later, the state of Oregon and NOAA agreed to emphasize voluntary efforts to restore the fish. In January, NOAA ruled that those voluntary efforts were enough to keep the fish off the list. With no federal protection, there are fewer regulations on activities that could affect the Oregon coastal coho salmon. These including logging, agriculture, land development, and restoration work. NOAA Fisheries has no comment about the lawsuit. Among the groups suing, the Oregon Natural Resources Council, Pacific Rivers Council, Trout Unlimited, Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations, the Native Fish Society, Umpqua Watersheds, the Coast Range Association, and the Institute for Fisheries Resources.
Tonight, the citizen group Save Cedar Mill holds a community forum on the Walmart Supercenter planned for their neighborhood. Organizers are working to prepare for upcoming public meetings May 2nd and 3rd on Walmart's application to build in the Beaverton community. Speakers include State Representatives Mitch Greenlick and Brad Avakian. Tonight's forum is at Cedar Park Middle School, 11100 Southwest Parkway in Portland. For more information, go to www.savecedarmill.com.
Former Enron executive Jeff Skilling remains on the stand today as his cross-examination continues. FSRN's Lisa Cohen reports from the Enron trial in Houston.
The former president and CEO has responded to a broad range of questions, including his own calendar entries, with, quote, "I don't recall." When prosecutor Sean Berkowitz asked about Enron's fourth quarter 1999 earnings release, which is alleged to have been changed at the last minute per Skilling's order to meet Wall Street analyst expectations, Skilling asked, quote, "Was I in town that day?" Skilling also denied, then qualified, requesting a lessons learned meeting in the summer of 2000, which reviewed Enron's poorly performing asset portfolio. Many of those assets ended up in the Raptors, the off-balance sheet vehicles that were hedged with Enron stock and hastened the collapse of the company when the stock price fell in 2001. Skilling will likely remain on the stand through the week. From KPFT, I'm Lisa Cohen.
The GOP is facing a civil war on the subject of undocumented workers. U.S. Representative Tom Tancredo of Colorado has been outspoken in favoring the deportation of undocumented workers. He said yesterday that he would campaign against fellow Republicans who disagree with him. Tancredo says that providing a path to citizenship for undocumented workers is a form of amnesty which he opposes. He once considered running for president, but has all but given up those plans. Instead, Tancredo said he is willing to help some candidates and work against others during the GOP presidential primary. In December, Tancredo helped pass a House bill that would impose sanctions on employers who hire undocumented workers. The bill also allowed for building a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border. The Senate left for a two-week holiday still deeply divided over proposed immigration legislation, leaving its fate uncertain. Tancredo has tried to be a force in the Senate debate. He began a campaign yesterday to pressure swing senators to pledge their support for an enforcement-only bill.
Georgia's Governor Sonny Perdue has signed into law a set of the new immigration measures for that state. The new law requires all persons over 18 years of age to prove their legal residence to receive public services. The law applies to local, state, or federal services received in the state of Georgia. Anyone receiving state benefits must sign an affidavit regarding their citizenship or legal immigration status. The law also requires a 6% sales state withholding tax for all workers who cannot document their legal residence. State police officials will be authorized to perform federal immigration enforcement and customs duties. The law is known as the Georgia Security and Immigration Compliance Act.
A California Republican has hired a former Kenneth Starr aide to help him with the Jack Abramoff problem. U.S. Representative John Doolittle says he needs advice on how to answer questions about his ties to the disgraced lobbyist. Doolittle's re-election campaign has paid $10,000 to the law firm that employs David Barger. Barger is a former assistant U.S. attorney who worked with Starr during the Whitewater investigation. Doolittle's chief of staff says the congressman wants to make sure that his public statements are accurate. He said Doolittle does not want to compromise on the ongoing federal investigation of Abramoff's associates.
The current time is 5:28, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's a modest suggestion for dealing with illegal immigration. Instead of everyone looking down at all those impoverished Mexicans coming here for jobs, why not start looking up? Focusing on the posh executive suites of corporate America, which has saddled both U.S. and Mexican working families with corporate written trade and labor policies that knock us all down. Let's start with NAFTA. Remember that Bill Clinton, the GOP, and all the corporate lobbyists promised that this trade deal would bring prosperity to Mexican laborers, thus stopping the flow of illegal workers into the USA. Well, 12 years later, real wages in Mexico are lower than before NAFTA was imposed. 19 million more Mexicans have fallen into poverty, and about half of Mexico's people are struggling to live on less than $5 a day. This NAFTA economy of a few fabulously rich families and an impoverished working class was deliberately created by a cabal of arrogance between CEOs in our country, the ruling elites in Mexico, and the political puppets of both. Now, here they come again, fostering xenophobia, proposing an absurd and shameful wall along our shared border, and encouraging a new Bracero program to turn low-wage Mexicans into a permanent flow of indentured workers for U.S. businesses. Meanwhile, these same corporations and their political puppets have been busting wages here at home, offshoring middle-class jobs, canceling pensions and health care plans, waging war against labor unions, and shredding our social contract. This is Jim Hightower saying, to deal effectively with illegal immigration, we must renegotiate these corporate trade scams and restore our labor laws so they actually help the workaday majority of people, raising middle-class possibilities here and in Mexico. This problem is not being caused by powerless people, but by the most powerful. It's time to look up and look the power elites right in their eye. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Molly Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear a special on transgendered politics by the Women's International News Gathering Service, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, Amanda Genus brings us Amanda's Jam Corner. Tonight, partly cloudy in Portland and Hood River, lows around 40. In Corvallis tonight, partly cloudy with lows 35 to 40. Tomorrow, partly sunny and 65 in Portland and Corvallis, with temperatures possibly reaching 70 in the Western Columbia Gorge. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The FBI is pressuring the family of Jack Anderson, the late investigative journalist, to allow agents to search his papers. KBOO's Steve Casburn has more.
Now that Jack Anderson is dead, the FBI wants to search his files. Anderson wrote the investigative newspaper column Washington Merry-Go-Round from 1969 to 2004. In the 1960s and 1970s, he played a role in investigative journalism similar to that played by Seymour Hersh today. Anderson could get information that no one else could. Authorities on several occasions tried to find the source of leaked information that became a staple of his syndicated column. Anderson's skill earned him both a Pulitzer Prize and a place on Richard Nixon's enemies list. He died on December 17th. Not long after his funeral, FBI agents called his widow. They said they wanted to search his papers for confidential government information. The agents told the family they planned to remove from the columnist's archive any document they came across that was stamped secret or confidential. Kevin Anderson, the columnist's son, said today his father would roll over in his grave if the FBI were allowed access to his files. Those files have been donated to George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Mark Feldstein, a GWU journalism professor and Anderson biographer, said he was visited in March at his home by FBI agents. The agents said they needed access to the papers. They asked if he had seen any classified documents. They wanted the names of all graduate students who had looked through the papers and questioned him about where the documents are housed and who controls access to them. The FBI's stated reason for wanting access to Anderson's files is to bolster the government's case against AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Two former AIPAC lobbyists have been charged with disclosing classified information. But, Anderson's family says, the AIPAC investigation dates back at least 5 years. They question why the FBI waited until right after Anderson died to finally make their request. They also do not believe that Anderson had had any dealings with the lobbyists under investigation. Still, when the FBI first called Olivia Anderson and said it was a matter of national security, the family was willing to consider the request. Jack Anderson himself cooperated with the FBI from time to time, his son said. The more the Andersons learned, however, the less willing they were to help. Kevin Anderson said lawyers for the family are preparing a letter to the FBI declining to cooperate. The FBI did not respond to several requests by the Associated Press for comment. Feldstein, the GWU professor, is writing a book about Jack Anderson's relationship with Nixon. Feldstein said this FBI attempt to review Anderson's files is part of the, quote, greatest assault on the news media since the Nixon administration. The information for this story was collected from the Associated Press and the Chronicle for Higher Education. I'm Steve Casburn, KBOO News.
Chinese President Hu Jintao arrives in the United States today. After dinner at Microsoft CEO Bill Gates' mansion tonight, he will meet with President Bush on Thursday in D.C. The White House says there's a great deal on the plate whenever the leaders of the world's leading developed nation and the world's leading developing nation meet. But with that much said, how can much actually be done? From Washington, Yan Meizi has a preview of each side's agenda.
Hu Jintao's visit will be his first to the White House since he resumed the presidency in China. as the U.S. has long watched the rapid rising of China with unease, and the Congress has been disgruntled with China's trade policy. President Bush has a long list of issues to discuss with President Hu. Derek Mitchell is the Senior Fellow of Asia Projects at the International Security Program, Center for Strategic and International Studies, an organization with strong ties to the government and the private industry.
Starting with the economic issues, the issues of trade, of intellectual property rights, of currency valuation. North Korea, want to make sure we get China to play along, North Korea bringing North Korea to the table, Iran. And for this president, the issue of religious freedom and human rights is always very critical.
As the U.S. has an annual deficit of more than $700 billion and growing, issues in trade will be front and center. Last week, a group of Chinese policymakers came to Washington, D.C. to meet with cabinet officials ahead of talks between the nation's two top leaders. The Chinese government agreed conditionally to further open up the Chinese market to U.S. products and to strengthen the intellectual property law enforcement. White House Press Secretary Scott McLennan says those commitments from China are a good start.
Those were important steps that were announced by China. Now we want to see those steps implemented.
Derek Mitchell says tough talk may be the only leverage the U.S. has on China, and Mr. Hu may simply brush it off.
So if the U.S. is not happy or resentful, I don't think he's that concerned, really. In fact, I think there's a little bit too much complacency in the Chinese government that there's not much we can do about it, that we are so codependent that anything we do is going to be counterproductive for our own interests we're trying to do to China.
Philip Swagel, international trade and financial policy scholar at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, says to overcome the barriers in trade talks, both sides have to move beyond harsh language.
They understand that they have a long list of economic issues that you know, things that we want from them, and they're working on it. And from their perspective, they're saying, look, we've got this financial sector that's, you know, got more scotch tape on it than you can imagine, and, you know, we're working on cleaning it up. We move the exchange rate, the whole thing will you know, come undone. So you need to understand our limitations.
As one of the five permanent members at the UN Security Council, China plays a pivotal role in pressing Iran to drop its nuclear programs. China and Russia oppose UN sanctions against Iran. State Department spokesman Sean McCormack says, despite China's reluctance to punish Iran, the U.S. and China can still seek common ground.
I can't believe that China wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon any more than the United States or the European countries or Russia.
However, Dan Blumenthal, an Asian scholar, also from the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, says the U.S. holds limited leverage to press China on the issue of Iran.
Well, the only leverage is sort of the moral suasion, the moral persuasion issue. So you say, you know, look, the entire world, it's not just the United States, it's the EU, it's countries, it's other countries in the Middle East don't want this to happen. And are you going to be the only outlying country that wants this to happen?
After trade and national security, human rights is likely to be another issue on President Bush's agenda. Derek Mitchell.
Privately, frankly, the president is very strong on human rights and religious freedom. And some people in the administration have even said that if he had his way, that's all he would talk about.
When Mr. Hu arrives in Washington, D.C. on Thursday, he will be greeted with a full military honors reception and a full 21-gun salute that befits the head of state. But Mr. Bush decided not to accord Mr. Hu a state dinner. Instead, only a social lunch will be hosted by the U.S. first couple. I'm Ye Meixie for Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C.
The Chinese president's visit to the U.S. is hot news in China as well as here. However, China's priorities for the visit seem to be far away from those of the United States. FSRN's Severine Bardon reports from Beijing.
As Chinese President Hu Jintao is set to begin his state visit to the United States, China is focusing on several issues that might be slightly different from what Washington is expecting. Qin Ninbo is a member of China's Institute of International Studies, a think tank linked to the Foreign Ministry.
Three sources of tension remain between China and the U.S. The first one is the question of Taiwan. Maybe the United States doesn't see it as the most important one, But if this issue is not handled properly, relations between China and the U.S. won't be able to stabilize. The second point is the commercial one, which includes several aspects such as trade deficit, property rights protection, money revaluation. Of course, these questions have been debated many times, but they could become hot topics, even though the two countries are willing to have a dialogue. The last point is security. Beside the Taiwan issue, the main remaining problems are the nuclearization of Iran and North Korea. But on this topic, China and the U.S. have had the same position for a long time. If relations between China and the United States become strained, it will be because of one of these three issues. We also have several historical disagreements which have not been solved, such as human rights or the religious situation in China. But I think the dialogue will go on these topics, and they won't cause any problems or threaten the relations between our two countries.
The White House hasn't mentioned Taiwan as a major topic of discussion for this visit, but it seems that China has high expectations in this matter. Jin Linbo details China's point of view.
I think the main issue for China is Taiwan. China's major objective is that the United States does not send the wrong message to Taiwan leaders. Maybe Taiwanese people have the idea that the U.S. supports the idea of independence. Before, we insisted on reunification. It was our most important duty. Now we don't focus on reunification, which nevertheless remains our ultimate goal, but we insist on opposing Taiwan's independence. Between the Chinese position, opposing independence, and the United States one, which could accept a status quo, there are several common points and moderate positions. If during the state visit, China and the U.S. could find even more common ground between their two positions, I think it would benefit the interest of both countries.
In February, China threatened to invade Taiwan if its leadership declared independence. This after Taiwan President Chen Shui-bian sidestepped discussions with China on reunification. At the same time, the Chinese military has built up its short-range missile capacity along the Strait of Taiwan, a 98-mile-wide waterway that separates the regions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Séverine Bardon in Beijing.
Freelance foreign correspondent Rhys Ehrlich just returned from Nepal on assignment for Canadian Broadcasting Corporation Radio and Australian Broadcasting. He reports that a popular revolution is building against the nation's totalitarian government, while few Western reporters are on the scene to tell the story. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Ehrlich earlier today about what's going on in Nepal.
2 weeks ago, exactly, a general strike and work stoppage broke out in Nepal, in opposition to the dictatorial rule of King Ganendra. The people are basically asking for very simple democratic demands like restoring parliamentary elections, freedom of speech and assembly, end of press censorship. The government, the king, seized power about a little over a year ago, and people are quite fed up with it and ready to see the king go. And I think the demonstrations were so strong that they surprised even the leaders of the political parties who called for the demonstration initially. I think it's gone farther and deeper than they had expected. And when I was there, there were some days when the government called a curfew and the streets were eerily empty. They would shut down all cell phones so that people couldn't use the phones to organize. Yet, at the appointed time, thousands of people turned out in the streets anyway, and held demonstrations and inevitably clashed with the police because anybody showing up on the street was considered illegal during the curfew. And right now the situation in Kathmandu is getting rather dire because after 2 weeks of no transport, food and other basic supplies are getting scarce in the capital. And so it's going to be coming to a head one way or another.
Rhys, can you give us a little more background on the current Nepalese government?
Sure. It's an independent country. It is sandwiched between China and India and is inevitably buffeted by the two larger countries' policies. But what the king is doing there is his own making. The recent history worth recounting begins about 5 years ago. Your listeners may remember that the crown prince, the son of the then king, walked into a monthly dinner party of the royal family and machine gunned about 11 people, including his father, his mother, and several other people that would have inherited the throne. He He then allegedly turned the AK-47 on himself and killed himself. So that then led to the current king, Ganendra, coming to power. He was the surviving heir to the throne. He's not been popular. His son is even less popular. He's been involved in several drunk driving accidents that resulted in people dying, and these guys are not doing the idea of a monarchy a whole lot of good. In fact, a lot of Nepalis, you have to remember that in Nepal for 200 years, the kings were considered gods. So there was much more than just a kind of normal monarchical system. If you question the king, you were questioning God. Well, a whole lot of people these days are questioning God, apparently, because the popular outrage at the king and the idea that even if when he dies, his son is going to take over is even more, gets people even more outraged. So the situation was that when the current king Ganendra came to power a few months after that assassination of his brother, he dissolved the parliament and appointed basically a cabinet that included some leading politicians. Then, roughly a year ago in February of last year, he dissolved that government and arrested the ministers that he had appointed. And he now rules together with the army as an absolute control of the country. And that's what really got people angry. And that over the past 14 months, people have seen press censorship and arrest and torture of dissidents, detaining people without trial, all the basic democratic freedoms that people have fought for so long in Nepal were just tossed out the window. And the economy has gotten worse, and the Maoist insurgency in the countryside has gotten even stronger. So the whole justification for dissolving the government and making himself absolute ruler was he was going to effectively fight the guerrillas. Well, that didn't happen. And, in fact, the guerrillas have now joined in an alliance with the political parties to oppose the king.
That was freelance reporter Rhys Ehrlich speaking with KABU's Lisa Loving. To hear the full interview, which details the Bush administration's support of Nepal's totalitarian government, go to our website, www.kabu.org.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has ordered the training and arming of a civilian militia. He says this militia will be prepared to fight a guerrilla war in case of a U.S. invasion. Chavez says he wants 1 million armed men and women in the Army Reserve. 150,000 have already joined, surpassing the regular military's force of 100,000. Critics of Chavez says the real goal of the mobilization is to create the means to suppress internal dissent. Venezuela's citizen soldiers come mostly from urban poor areas where Chavez draws his fiercest support. They train on weekends, learning how to handle assault rifles and run obstacle courses through clouds of tear gas. Chavez insists the plotters of a 2002 coup that briefly unseated him had Washington's blessing. The U.S. quickly recognized the interim leaders. Also, U.S. intelligence documents indicate the CIA knew dissident military officers were plotting against Chavez. Chavez reminds his people the United States invaded Grenada and Panama to topple regimes it considered hostile. In both cases, resistance quickly crumbled. Cuba's defeat of a CIA-trained force at the Bay of Pigs in 1961 is the model Chavez wants to follow.
Oil prices hit a record high of more than $72 a barrel today. Analysts cite fears about Iran's nuclear program and possible cuts in supply. Iran is the world's fourth largest crude exporter. This, as reports suggest, that Venezuela could soon be considered the new world leader in oil reserves. FSRN's Mike Fox has more from Caracas.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez says that if OPEC formally recognizes his country's extra-heavy crude deposits, Venezuela will surpass Saudi Arabia as the world leader in proven oil reserves. According to BBC journalist Greg Palast, an internal study from the U.S. Department of Energy has determined that Venezuela could have reserves of over 1 trillion barrels. This news comes as the Bush administration is exerting increased pressure on oil-rich Iran over the development of its nuclear program. The Venezuelan government has publicly opposed any military action against Iran. Meanwhile, the Venezuelan paper 2001 reported that U.S. intelligence claims to have discovered the existence of a secret agreement between Iran and Venezuela, whereby Iran will send nuclear weapons to Venezuela and Cuba. This morning, Venezuelan Minister of Foreign Affairs Ali Rodriguez Arroque called the claims part of a chain of absurd accusations fired at Venezuela over the past few years. Caracas has denied various rumors of the past year that Venezuela is sending uranium to support Iran's nuclear program. Mike Fox, FSRN, Caracas.
Buenos Aires city officials tried to stop unemployed workers from starting a soup kitchen in a city neighborhood yesterday. Five demonstrators were arrested and several injured by police. FSRN's Maria Tringona has more from Buenos Aires.
Police arrested Picatero leader Raul Castells during the opening of a soup kitchen in primary school in a chic Buenos Aires neighborhood yesterday. Castells' group, the Independent Movement of Pensioners and Unemployed, or MEECT, planned to open a soup kitchen in the central flea market that had been closed down for safety violations. Police violently evicted demonstrators while they tried to enter the flea market. Castells was arrested on charges of aggravated destruction and robbery. Castells spent several months in prison on similar charges last year for taking over a McDonald's restaurant, demanding hamburgers for the unemployed. MEECT recently opened a soup kitchen in the exclusive Puerto Madero, the most expensive neighborhood in Argentina. Meanwhile, human rights groups blocked a central intersection to mark International Day in solidarity with political prisoners and to press for the release of some 20 political prisoners currently held in Argentina. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Chigona in Buenos Aires.
The Russian Duma will not change the Russian constitution to let President Vladimir Putin run for a third term in 2008. This, according to the Speaker of the Duma, Boris Gryzlov, in a statement made today. Gryzlov heads the party that has a large majority in the Duma. Putin himself has also said the constitution should not be changed. Many politicians and groups, however, are calling for him to stay in office after his second term ends. The Russian constitution, passed in 1993, limits presidents to two consecutive terms. Constitutional changes require approval by a two-thirds majority in the Duma, a three-fourths majority in the upper house, and local legislatures in at least two-thirds of Russian's provinces. If Putin wanted to receive this approval, he could likely get it easily. Putin enjoys strong public support, and pro-government lawmakers dominate parliament. But extending his time in office would further blacken his reputation among Western governments that accuse him of backtracking on democracy.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 18th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock Revis. Our assistant producer is Steve Casburn. Tonight's audio editor is Angela Hancock Revis. Special thanks to reporters Steve Casburn, Stephanie Potter, Jacob Fenston, and Lisa Loving. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Stephanie Potter. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by independent native news. Coming up for tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7:30, Barbara Bernstein hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. She'll preview the National Federation of Community Broadcasters Conference, which is being held in Portland this week, and she'll speak with local activist Kathleen Sadat about the Oregonians' coverage of the accusations against Portland Police Chief Derek Foxworth. Is their slant an attack on Mayor Potter? At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Vets for Peace. At 10, on People Rise Up, host Andrew Geller speaks with Mary Booth, senior scientist with the Environmental Working Group and lead author of their new report about the Gulf Coast Dead Zone and its taxpayer-subsidized causes. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 18th of April. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. This is National Minority Cancer Awareness Week, and the American Cancer Society is targeting minority populations regarding the importance of early detection. Jackie Edscorn from Dupree, South Dakota, is the National Miss Indian Rodeo. She says there have been tremendous advances in cancer prevention, detection, and treatment, but minorities, especially in underserved areas, are still at high risk. Edscorn says it's a major concern because Native American communities continue to have the poorest survival rate from all cancers.
They have inadequate health insurance, and there's a lack of education, and most of them live in very rural areas. There's unemployment, poverty, and language barriers. I've had several family members who have went through and survived cancer, and it affects everybody, not just the patient. It affects the whole family.
Edscorn says the American Cancer Society is trying to overcome cancer disparities by ensuring that minority populations have access to quality health care, including affordable or free health insurance.
There's been steady improvements in cancer prevention. Early detection has been improved also, but not all populations have benefited by this equally. The sooner a person is able to get checked out for cancer by taking either the pap smears or mammograms or the colon cancer test, the better chance they have for surviving, because they can get the cancer detected faster and get it treated, have a better chance at survival.
Edscorn says the country's minority and underserved citizens are currently bearing an unequal burden, with a higher risk of developing cancer and a lower rate of early diagnosis, treatment, and survival. In other news, a business of the Yakima Nation in Washington State has been part of new ventures lately, which is drawing national attention to the only tribally owned juice company in the country, Yakima Juice. Reggie George of KYNR Radio on the Yakima Nation has details.
Purchased in 2004, Yakima Juice is located in Seattle, Washington. 48 of the 80 employees are tribal members. Assistant Manager Harris Teo says they've recently reached a distribution deal with chain store Costco to distribute organic apple and pomegranate juices in the Northwest states and Canada.
Initially, when we started, it wasn't our goal to do this. It wasn't our goal to have our label on a shelf somewhere.
Along with the recent Costco distribution deal, Yakima Juice is also involved in community events while receiving several prestigious awards.
One thing that we're fairly excited about is today we received notification from USDA AMS program that we're nominated for the Hub Zone of the Year Award, National Award. Hub Zone is a historically underutilized business site.
Yakima Juice has high hopes the Costco agreement will lead to more positive things for tribal businesses. For Independent Native News, I'm Reggie George in Seattle, Washington.
Data shows that tribal casinos in Southern California may not be competing with Las Vegas casinos at all. In fact, they may be bringing business to Vegas. Ellen Cherchak reports.
Tribal casinos may actually be helping business in Vegas by introducing gambling to people who have never tried it before. The numbers seem to back up this theory held by William Thompson, a professor of public administration at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Over the past 2 years, Las Vegas casinos have posted their steepest revenues since 1999, growing by nearly $2 billion. And Southern Californians made up 29% of the 39 million people who visited Las Vegas last year, up from 27% the year before. Even so, tribal gaming is doing just fine. Tribal casinos in California took in $5.8 billion in 2004, the most recent year figures were available, and California's tribal casinos have the most revenues of any in the nation. I'm Ellen Cherchak in Sacramento.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com.